Welcome to episode 8 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
So this episode we are going to delve into
epic
films, which has been quite epic in its own right.
Oh, I missed that one. Epic in its own right.
Watching three epic films
in a short space,
in a short space of time
is an epic ask.
I mean, you've got, I think, 4 hours for Gone with the Wind, which we'll be discussing. 3.5 hours for Dr. Zhivago.
And about 2¾, I think, is it, for The English Patient.
That's right. Mm. They're the three films we'll be discussing.
So all up, that's getting close to 10 hours.
10 hours in a short space of time.
And that's like watching, you know, binge-watching a series, basically.
It is.
Season of a TV series. That's a lot. Mm. But for our listeners, we are dedicated.
Absolutely.
What I find interesting about our choices is that we haven't gone for the obvious epics like, you know, The Sword and Sandals. There's no Barabbas, The Robe.
I mean, there's so many epics to choose from.
Which is disappointing because I've come specially in my, you know, chainmail. And if you could just move your sword, because that hurts a bit. Thank you. And we had to do this quickly because my chariot's outside actually in a 1 hour zone.
Okay, Greg, tell us about the first iconic classic, Gone with the Wind.
Okay, well, it seems almost pointless to provide an overview of Gone with the Wind. Few films are as iconic, although, curiously, 1939 was a year for iconic films. We had The Wizard of Oz, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Dark Voyager, Wuthering Heights, and even Basil Rathbone's first Sherlock Holmes film, The Hound of the Baskerville. So it was a big year for films.
Quite a big year.
And I was interested to find out that Margaret Mitchell, who wrote the book of Gone with the Wind, said that if Gone with the Wind has a theme, it's that of survival. And you might be forgiven for thinking that she was referring to the audience of this four-hour film. Mm. It's the story of Scarlett O'Hara, Vivian Leigh, a Southern belle from a wealthy family on the eve of the American Civil War. At a neighbourhood barbecue, although I suspect quite different to our own Aussie barbecues, she meets local rogue Captain Rhett Butler, Clark Gable. Whereas Rhett is immediately captivated by the young Spitfire and remains so for many years, Scarlett is obsessed with her neighbour Ashley Wilkes, Leslie Howard. Unfortunately, Ashley has just become engaged to his incredibly virtuous cousin, Melanie Hamilton, Olivia de Havilland. Scarlett, and to a lesser extent the other three, form the cornerstone of a home front saga that encompasses the Civil War and its aftermath, including extreme poverty in the wake of destruction, and then the rebuilding of the South. These characters are surrounded by many others, both temporary and recurring across the years. Black and white, Southerner and Yankee, respectable society folk, less desirable free people and slaves. There are some wonderful actors in here, including Hattie McDaniel as Mammy, who was the first African-American Oscar nominee and winner for this part. Thomas Mitchell as Scarlett's father, who was Uncle Billy in one of our favourites, It's a Wonderful Life, and actually won an Oscar in the same year for Stagecoach as Doc Boone. Ona Munson as a Madam of the Night, Belle Watling. Jane Darwell, who I think fondly of as Feed the Birds Lady in Mary Poppins. And George Reeves, TV's first Superman, in a Blink and You'll Miss It cameo at the start. But Ricardo, what did you think of this iconic film?
You know, one thing that really struck me, I mean, I really love the film, obviously. It is a classic. It's the first time I'd seen it. So I've never seen, this is a confession, I'd never seen Gone with the Wind. So I was really excited to see the film. What really struck me when I was watching it, I was going, this almost seems, you know, ahead of its time in terms of the character of Scarlett O'Hara. You know, here is a spoilt, beautiful, cunning, business-minded, strong woman, which for the time was quite different. I love the setting. I love the cinematography. It was amazing. All that, it was Technicolor, and it was quite new back then. I was riveted to it. I wasn't bored. I found the two halves quite contrasting. I found the second half a bit longer. It sort of drew out quite a little bit, maybe too long than what I thought.
Actually, it is longer because the first half's at the, I think, 1 hour and 1¾ hour mark.
Oh, right. So it is longer.
And then the second half goes almost up to 4 hours. Yeah. So it's significantly longer.
It is. And it feels that a bit. I feel like it just keeps dragging on and on quite a bit. There's a lot happening in the first half.
Oh, yeah.
A lot. So you've got the rise of the Civil War, picking up the pieces from the Civil War.
And I think it's only in the first half, except the very start of the second half, where you get all those kind of title cards to tell you what's going on.
That's right.
Because you've been whisked through history, and so you're being given these cues that say, and now this is going on, or this, you know, this happened, and then you see the story against that to almost illustrate
it. It's interesting.
For the second half, you just get the story.
This was a talkie. Talkies had been around for 12 years, okay, when came out. This was 1939, as you said. It was a great year for cinema. Yet when I was watching this, I was still thinking the direction of it, they still hadn't sort of gotten out of that silent film era a little bit with the title cards and whatnot. Just felt very, very silent movie-ish.
Yeah, but actually I liked that.
So do I.
And in fact, I felt the lack of that in Dr. Zhivago, which we'll talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Zhivago, I very, very vaguely knew the history and I felt really lost because I had no idea like who are these groups and what's going on.
Yeah.
I probably know a little bit more about the Civil War, but it told me what was going on.
It did, yeah.
To help me make sense of what I was seeing, and I actually liked that.
Yeah, so did I. But I still think some of the acting as well, some of the performances, not the two leads, I think Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh are phenomenal. They're really great in this. And so is Hedy McDaniel as well, is wonderful. I was a bit put off by some of the other African American the way they were portrayed.
Is it Prissy, the maid?
Yeah,
Prissy. I could have cheaply throttled her.
And also the guys as well. The men in there were very much stupid sounding. You know, really, and not intelligent. And so I really didn't like that aspect of it. I think Hedy was the only one really. Amazingly, she didn't actually get invited. She couldn't go to the premiere in Atlanta.
And Clark Gable was not going to go for that reason until she insisted. Basically,
wow. Yeah.
They were apparently very good friends for. You know, going forward.
Mm.
Well, let me tell you about my response to it. This is the third of these three films to watch, and as you can probably well imagine yourself, I'd already watched two long films. I was thinking, oh no, now there's the 4-hour one I've got to watch. And I have actually seen this before a long, long time ago. I saw it at the movies. I arrived a little bit late, and I was bored by it. And that's pretty much all I remember of it. So I thought, oh, I don't know about this, but, you know, duty calls. And once I got past the start with all the long playing music, which is the fixed slide, which Zhivago does as well. And
oh, but I just fast forward through those. I can't handle that.
And the exit music at the end.
No credits, just exit music.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I'd stopped it by then. That's it.
Says a lot about the different context in which we view it into how it was
absolutely
made.
Gone. No.
Gone with
paused.
The wind.
Yeah, gone with the wind. That's it.
No, gone with the wind.
Wind. Finished. Stop.
Anyway, I was reluctant to watch it, as I said. And then I really got into it, particularly the first half. I think the first half is far and away the stronger part of the story.
Completely.
And in many scenes, the most, you know, vivid and dramatic and almost theatrical, but it was filmic. You know, a lot of those shots of people standing against sunsets or the fire.
Beautifully done.
Or Scarlet under the bridge with the horse and carriage.
Gorgeous.
As the enemy goes overhead in a rainstorm.
Yeah.
Lots of scenes that were really, you know... It's a bit ironic because I'd forgotten the film from 20 years ago, whatever it was, but, you know, deeply memorable images. I didn't mind the burning of Atlanta. I know it's supposed to be a very, you know, seminal kind of scene, but the one where...
Yeah, well, that is an amazing scene. The burning of Atlanta is an amazing scene.
But for me, maybe logistically, filmically, I don't know, but for me it was the shot where she goes to get the doctor, Dr. Eads, to come and tend to Melanie's having the baby.
Yes.
And she's going into the street and the camera slowly pans out and she becomes this almost insignificant figure in the middle of a whole lot of dead and wounded lying in the street.
Yes.
So a lot of things in the first half that were really very strong.
That's right.
And so I became engaged almost in spite of myself.
Mm-hmm.
But the second half of the film, to me, felt like it had two halves. And I couldn't tell you where the break in that would be. But the first part of it was still a very strong story about, you know, the damage done to the South by the war, the reparation, people, you know, taking advantage of that loss, both locals and you know, the damn Yankees.
That's right, the damn Yankees, yeah.
But by the latter part of the film, when it's like disaster after disaster,
and you can
predict what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's very tragic and sad, yeah.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't find it sad at all.
You didn't find it sad?
No, I felt like we were going through and ticking the boxes, probably from Margaret Mitchell's book. And it was like thing, 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 and I lost patience with it. So apart from the iconic scenes at the end on the staircase and Rhett, you know, what will I do if you go? What will become of me? And frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Well, that line.
There's always tomorrow's another day and there's always Tara. The end of it was strong, but there was about half an hour to an hour before that where I was just kind of like, I'm not sure how much I should say, but, you know, that character's going to die, that character's going to die, that bad thing's going to happen. I could just see it all happening.
Well, I couldn't.
Oh, no, I just sort of thought...
I couldn't at all. Actually, I think because you'd know the story. I didn't know
No, it was also the storytelling. I found the storytelling...
No, I found it quite long. I found it longer, but no, I had no idea that was going to happen. So, to me, when... Okay, that line, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. I've heard it so many times. I've heard it said many times. I've heard it played at the Oscars many times. But in the context of this film, of watching the story, when he says that, it hurts. And it's quite a very powerful line in the context of the story.
But as I said, my problem's not that part.
I understand that.
Let me get do you?
Those sequence of events, those tragic events, were all put together for the reason of showing the downfall of their relationship. So when it came to one of the end moments when she chooses Ashley, who she's been in love with the whole film, to hug other than Rhett, and he walks away, he's had enough.
Yes.
Okay, so I didn't those parts, they're needed. Those tragic moments are needed. Yeah. I know. I understand what you're saying, that you feel like they were just getting through the novel or something, but I didn't feel like that at all. I felt like that would need, if they were not there...
No, but my problem isn't really the events. It was the way the events were told. It was like a whistle-stop tour. It's like boom, 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 and not bothering to tell other parts of the story. So when Rhett is deeply devastated by a particular death, and he's locked himself in a room, no one's allowed to go in.
That's right.
And then cousin Melanie, Olivia de Havilland, says, "I'll go and talk to him."
Mm-hmm.
And she goes inside, she closes the door, and then, you know, there's a dissolve, and she's coming out of the door, and she's totally turned red around, and then she falls over and faints.
Yes.
That whole cutting out of that conversation, the psychology around that conversation for both characters, should have been there.
Mm.
That's what I mean. It was like boom, 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 you know, and we're getting towards the closure of a four-hour film, so there's someone in the background saying, "Don't make it 5 hours, don't make it 5 hours." But it was just like, tragedy, tragedy, tragedy. Oh, I so knew that was going to happen. That's when it lost me. And so I went into it thinking, I have to watch this, but kind of thing. And the first half was so strong.
It is very strong.
And the story about what happens to her and the people around her after the war.
And the way she grows. The way she grows.
And that's the strength of the film as it a is. Character.
Yes. Because she's annoying. She's absolutely
much
annoying.
Much more than Rhett.
Yeah,
Rhett has his own arc.
He does.
But she really does.
She's so a little spoiled.
Oh, she's a pain in the whatever.
She's quite annoying to begin with. But then she's a strong woman. She's strong for everybody.
Well, that's what Margaret Mitchell actually means more seriously about, you know, if there's a theme, it's about survival. She talks about the fact that when disasters strike... or the sustained problems, some people make their way through it. She calls it gumption, and some don't. And that's what she was interested in. And Scarlett has that in spades.
But the fact that they chose a female to show that, I think is quite progressive in the time.
You might be right. I can't tell. Look, I'm prepared to say that's true, which is very magnanimous of me, really. I'm sorry. Sorry. I don't mean to be patronising. I'm saying, look, that could well be true. I guess what I focus on is that... It is such a solid journey, and Vivien Leigh is so watchable all the way through.
Oh, she's
like amazing. She was, I think, 26 when she made this. Olivia de Havilland was only 23.
Yeah,
Both very young women playing women over, you know, a sustained arc of their lives. So they start, you know, I think when they're supposed to be like 16, 20, and then it goes up to, and they must be sort of like 45, 50, maybe 45. And to see them and to see how they kind of... almost settle into different sorts of... Well, not so much Melanie, because, you know, she's so worthy, you get a bit sick of it.
I think one of the big moments for Scarlett in that was when she kills the Yankee. That's a massive moment. And I was quite shocked by that moment as well, because I didn't expect it to happen.
I saw it coming, and again, it's a bit hard to say, because I had seen it a long time ago, but I guess what was more shocking is the fact that she shot him in the face.
Yeah, yes. You know, she was on screen for about 2 hours and 23 minutes. I think it's the longest Academy Award winner in his on-screen time
quite possibly. Ever.
She was on screen for 2 hours and 23 minutes, I think. But I also loved the screenplay as well.
Yeah.
I loved the witty little jibes they had at each other, Scarlett and Rhett.
Oh, yes.
Look, Clark Gable is wonderful. I haven't seen that much Clark Gable in that many movies, so I just thought, yes, you are a Hollywood icon movie star because you're amazing on screen. He looks amazing on screen.
Well, the part was originally going to Gary Cooper, and he backed away from it thinking it would be a huge failure. And Gary Cooper, I think, would have been too stolid in the role, role, whereas Clark Gable really brings that kind of, you know, the twinkle in the eye, charm and roguishness. But
the only thing that's missing is the little ding.
Yes, but when he has his crises, they are believable as well.
They really are.
And even the little arc of his relationship with Mammy, where he says, I know you don't like me, and he says to Scarlett, she doesn't like me, but then he buys her the red petticoat, and she grows to like him, and that's believable.
Yeah, that is believable. All of that is, yeah.
And if you, I guess, deeper in the story, I think it's a really good insight into why the South could really have carried forward a legacy of hating the North. It wasn't just the Civil War, which is the bits that I'd sort of understood, but the whole what happened afterwards was something I didn't know about, and I don't remember from last time, and I found that really interesting and insightful.
Mm.
And there was also one moment that really moved me. You know the scene where there's a whole lot of people in town and they're waiting for the dispatch that says, who's died?
Yeah.
And so they're waiting to hear if Ashley's died, you know, Melanie and Scarlett waiting. But there's two characters who never get names where the wife goes up to the band leader and just looks at him and he just knows she's, I think, weeping and he turns around to conduct his band playing, you know, trombones or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that moment between the two of them was just so perfect.
Mm.
I loved it. I don't think we can talk about Gone with the Wind, though, without talking about some of, well, at least for me, some of the discomfort I had, because it starts out with the opening title card celebrating that vanished world of gentility and of slave and master.
Yes.
And so I already sat down to watch this film thinking, not sure if I'm going to enjoy this. And I saw that, I thought, whoa.
Yeah.
And you talked about, you know, how Mammy's quite a strong character.
She is, yeah.
Prissy, as I say, I could cheerfully throttle. I could throttle her and Melanie and Ashley. I've got sick of all of them for various reasons. And the two, I think there were two male slaves in the household. There was Big Sam, who was a bit more of a character a couple of times.
Well, it doesn't surprise me.
It was Mammy, but the whole thing about that world celebrating slavery. I just sat there thinking.
Well, it was of that world. So
But you could show that in the film.
Mm.
And even back then, it was probably too much to critique it. But to celebrate it in the title card for me was. I don't know if it was text taken directly from Margaret Mitchell's novel.
Well, it's interesting.
I just didn't.
Interesting looking at another epic, which was made in 1914 or 16.
I know what you're going to say. Birth of a Nation, by any chance?
Yeah, that's right. D.W. Griffith.
Which I've yet to see.
When that came out, that was all about the Ku Klux Klan and it was portraying them as heroes. They had white people in blackface and all the African Americans were portrayed as the enemy in that movie. And so he was branded a racist, he was branded this and that. But he was saying, hang on a minute, this is the time. I'm showing the time here of what this is like. So he went away and made Intolerance because of that. I don't know if I agree completely with what I think it was a bit
you
of
You could
excuse,
get away with that if they hadn't had that celebratory title card. Even that early scene of all the women after the barbecue party upstairs in their corsets, lying there in the sun, being fanned by the small slave girls or the slave boys on the wheel ringing the bell.
Yeah.
Little things there that they didn't sit comfortably.
No, they don't, and it doesn't. So it has dated in that sort of sense, okay? And I know that there's articles about there of how, you know, how it can't be sort of the greatest film ever made anymore, you know, because of that. And going back to The Birth of a Nation, it was based on The Klansman, which is all about the Ku Klux Klan, on the novel The Klansman. So,
Yeah, one last thing perhaps that struck me about this film and the fact it was made the same year as The Wizard of Oz. Both those films really almost as kind of its central mantra is that there's no place like home.
Mm.
You know, Tara is home. Tara is the place where everything will get worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure someone who's a social historian could make more of this, but I found it interesting that, you know, the year that war was breaking out in Europe and America was still, you know, not in that world yet. But I thought that's interesting. Those two films are really, you know, home. Home is important. But anyway, what will you give this out of 10?
Look, I feel like I've got to give this two ratings, really.
I think you give it two out of 10.
No, definitely not. I won't do a U, you know, so that's fine. No, No, I feel like for the time when it was made, it's pretty outstanding, and, you know, for the time it was made. So I think for the time it was made, and for it should be a 10 because it's quite amazing. For now, I'll give it a 7, okay, because I think it has dated in a way which the other films we're going to talk about haven't really as much in its style. So a 7, I think, for the present day.
Well, I hadn't been quite so precise.
Okay. Oh, it's hard. It's hard. And it's hard for these films because, you know, they are iconic. You know, other than The English Patient, which I think is we'll talk about, but especially Zhivago and Gone with the Wind are iconic films, you know.
Well, for me, it's an 8. For me watching it now, it's an 8. A part of that score, I guess, is thinking, you know, that is such an achievement at that point in movie history, as indeed I think The Wizard of Oz is, which we should talk about one day. It's an amazing achievement. I thought I'd go into it thinking, oh, look, it'll get, you know, a bit of an a pass score kind of thing. But the first half was really strong.
It really is.
And then the part after the intermission, it's long. I mean, in the end, I watched it in 2 sittings, either side of the intermission, partly because, you know, it's a working week.
So did I. I watched it the same way.
Yeah, I know.
But when that moment at the end of the first half, when she says, I will never...
What does be she poor say? Again.
I will never be poor again. It's quite a powerful moment.
Oh, it is. And the only reason that it's not a 9 or a 10 is because that bit towards the end really, for me, was just like, you know, oh, yeah, okay. I thought the storytelling then... fell apart a bit. So, yeah, it's an 8 for me. So on to our second epic, which is Dr. Zhivago. Ricardo, tell us about that.
Okay, Dr. Zhivago. Directed by the epic movie maestro David Lean, Dr. Zhivago was released in 1965. It's set before, during and after the Russian Revolution of 1917. It's a magnificent spectacle. It begins in the present day, 1940s to 50s, with General Yevgraf Zhivago, Alec Guinness, who is searching for the daughter of his half-brother, Dr. Yuri Zhivago, Omar Sharif, and Larissa, Lara Antipova, played by Julie Christie. General Yevgraf suspects that a young woman, Tanya Rita Tushingham, might be his niece, so decides to tell her the story of her father's life. For this type of large story, it's a narrative device that works, the story being told through flashback and voiceover when required. The film centres around young Dr. Yuri Zhivago, from his early years being brought up and raised by his aunt and uncle and cousin Tonya following his parents' death, to later, when Yuri falls for Lara, who has been having an affair with her mother's lover, Viktor Komarovsky, Rod Steiger, a hard businessman. Yuri ends up marrying his cousin, Tonya, Geraldine Chaplin. However, when he and Lara meet again years later, when she ends up working for him as a nurse, their spark reignites. But with a pregnant wife and child, Yuri suddenly finds himself challenged in more ways than one. Look, it's a love story on a grand scale. And as with all these films we're discussing here, all ending somewhat tragically, but not without hope. It deservedly won 5 Academy Awards for the stunning cinematography, the screenplay, musical score, art direction and costume, but it lost out to The Sound of Music for Best Picture and Best Director. This, to me, is pure cinema. Greg?
Well, first of all, full marks to you for getting all those names in your introduction. I don't think I could have done it anywhere near as half as well.
That's why you got me to do Zhivago.
Well, that and the fact that I kept watching it, you know, looking for the songs like Mr. Cellophane and, you know, all that jazz. Zhivago. Actually, I think it might have been made into a musical anyway, but anyway, I diverge. I didn't like this.
What?
Nah, it didn't work for me.
What?
No. Do you want to say that once more?
I'll say that again, actually. No. I'm actually very surprised at this.
Go on. Oh. Do you what?
Okay, look, I first saw this at the Astor Cinema in 70mm. I was blown away by it. It's an amazing achievement. Why? How can you not like this one?
I found it very interesting in your introduction when you say what it did win the Academy Awards for. It won for cinematography, screenplay, musical score, art direction and costume. And I suspect they're all very well deserved. Now, I didn't see it on a big screen. You know, I saw it on my average-ish size TV at home. And I recognise that that stuff would have been really impressive on the big screen, and I probably would have liked it more. And I did like it in what I saw. You know, there are stunning shots in this. When they walk into the ice-encrusted house.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe.
And I was doing a bit of reading about how they did that. That was all wax, apparently, you know, in summer.
Mm.
So the effects that they achieved in some of those kind of things, there were some very powerful scenes, such as when the armed soldiers rode down the night snowy street to attack the peaceful marching men and children.
Yeah.
Very, very powerful scenes. Mm. My problem, again, was story. And my problem was the characters. I didn't believe the characters.
How? Well, who? Either the leads?
I wonder if to what degree it's a function of the fact that you saw it on the big screen and I did not. Mm. So because I'm not sort of totally caught up in the spectacle and not only some of the beauty, but some of those scenes like the attack on the workers, the march, because that was really beautiful and beautifully photographed, but not, I wasn't kind of almost inside it, I think I sat back more and looked at the story as well, and I didn't believe the characters. So when I talked about Gone with the Wind, about how I thought there was shortchanging in the telling, so that Melanie goes into the room with Rhett and then she comes out, you don't actually see what happened. I felt, for example, the same way about Zhivago and Lara. I didn't understand why they actually loved each other. Like, he was very struck by her when he saw her, you know, shoot her lover at the party where his engagement has just been announced. Mm. So I get why she's kind of on his radar. Then we see them retreating from the battle with the convoy. She watches him perform surgery by, I think, candlelight in the back of a truck in the middle of nowhere. So she admires his skill. Then they get to this place where they're going to have a hospital for all the wounded soldiers.
That's right.
Next thing we know, they're actually leaving the hospital. She's ironing a shirt and they're talking, and then they tell us that they love each other. Well, you say you love each other.
I'm actually big deal.
I wanted to see more of the development of that relationship.
Yeah, so because, yeah, amazingly, because I know you.
No, I
the way
didn't
you
believe
put it,
them.
You know what? You know what's a big thing about this film is its expression. I think the expression of Omar Sharif and what's said under the dialogue is everything in this movie. I mean, his expression, his eyes pierce through the screen. I think he's quite wonderful. And so does Julie Christie with her magnificent blue eyes as well.
Yes, I agree.
But I didn't feel what you felt. I understood the feeling of their love just through watching it. I just felt their love. When he was longing for her at the very end and finding her, I felt
I didn't know where it came from. I can see the arc, the progression with Rhett and Scarlett in Gone with the Wind. There's the moment where she throws the piece of porcelain across the room when she's frustrated with Ashley, who's just walked out of the library. And then Rhett pops up over the sofa and he's laughing because he's seen her spirit.
Yeah.
So that's almost analogous to Lara in Zhivago shooting the guy at the party. Mm-hmm. You know, the woman gets the man's attention by her spirit, her character. But then we saw how they spoke about each other and the events they went through together much more in Gone with the Wind than we did in Zhivago. I felt like those characters really lost against the epic. And in fact, the character I found most interesting that we barely saw was Tom Courtenay as Julie Christie's first husband.
Yes.
That character who starts out as, you know, a romantic poet who writes of love and his love for Lara, but who's also, you know, against the establishment. Who then goes through traumatic events, both when the soldiers mow down the marches and then later when he's leading men into battle on the, I think it's the fields of World War One.
That's right, and he's changed his name. He's become...
And then you don't see him for a while. Then he comes back, he's changed his name, and he's this very emotionless kind of general slash almost bureaucrat ideologue.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is actually a more interesting story. I would like to know more about that character. I kind of got and kind of didn't get the Rod Steiger character. I would know a bit more about him as well. But Zhivago grows up with his cousin Tonya. So they hang out together a lot. They both like each other. They get married. You know, again, I really didn't feel like I got much of a sense of their relationship either, other than the fact they were together.
I felt like they really loved each other in terms of, I mean, they grew up with each other. They're pretty much step brother and sister.
Yeah, they had a genuine respect and at least an affection, if not love, for each other.
They did, but...
And he grew, if he wasn't in love with her, he grew into love, in fact, with both women.
Mm.
Because at different times he thought he saw each of them in different places. Yeah, and
how could you not be moved? Tell me something. How can you not be moved when he leaves? He's made his decision. He says to Julie Christie, he says, you know, that is it. That is the last time I'm going to see you. And he's going back. Now he's left his pregnant wife and child at the place, the country place they're staying at, yeah. And he gets captured. And you think, how did you feel in that moment with poor Geraldine Chaplin sitting in there?
Well, I wasn't moved because I didn't believe those relationships.
You weren't moved at all. Mood.
Again, you've got an analysis situation in The English Patient where the Ralph Fiennes character, the patient, the count. Which we'll talk about in a moment, I know, but he makes a promise to go back to Kristen Scott Thomas, and again, circumstances stop him from doing that.
Yeah.
I was moved by that because I believed their relationship. Mm. I just didn't in Zhivago. Now, Zhivago is a beautiful film, absolutely.
Oh, the way they do some of the cinematography and the way
what and some
they
of
do
the shots.
The shots are beautiful. The reflections in the glass.
There's a scene where Julie Christie is pirouetting, I think, in the red dress for Rod Steiger, and you see in the mirror, so you don't see her head.
No.
And so that's a really nice way of saying he's objectifying her and her body.
Yeah.
So there's some very clever stuff.
Clever.
The scene where Rod Steiger panics running through the house when her mother has tried to commit suicide.
That's right.
And we're outside the whole time looking through different windows around the house.
Yeah, it was very Hitchcock, actually. Well, it felt like very Hitchcock.
And the arrival of the train in the station.
Yeah, very
good. Sheet of ice across the carriage door. There were lots of moments that visually and, you know, filmically were splendid.
Mm.
And as I say, I think would have been more splendid on the big screen, but yeah, I just it is. But the story didn't work for me.
For me, the story and the performances,
not the story, the characters' relationships didn't work,
and all of that to me fitted perfectly. I think I was very moved by it, and I always am moved by it. I loved Alec Guinness,
and I was looking forward to it because I know you really love this film.
I do.
And I'm sorry.
I mean, look, it's interesting because when you see it at somewhere in 70mm at the cinema at the Astor, I mean, it is a spectacle to do that. I was ready for it when I watched it, and I just was captivated from the first frame.
Look, and technically, there is so much to really love about this film. And, you know, I think of other shots, like the major, whoever he was, who was standing on a barrel and then shot and then sinks down in the barrel and the water turns red. Mm. Things that are visually, like, just very powerful. Even the sound design. At the very start of the film, when young Zhivago, did you realise that was Emma Sharif's son?
No.
Playing him, Tariq.
No, I didn't. Sharif, no, that was, no, I didn't.
Which is why they look so alike and the same big, beautiful, liquid eyes. In the scene where his mother's being buried, the sound on that was very harsh and brutal and worked really, really well. So when the film started, I thought I would really enjoy it because I could see it early on, you have a technical care of the sound, that some of the visuals I'd already seen, and probably up to and beyond the attack on the crowd in the street, I was there, but I never got into the story because I didn't feel like I could get into the relationships. And my other problem, as I said before when we were talking about Gone with the Wind, was I felt lost in the history. So we talked earlier about the Russian Ark.
I agree with you on that one there.
I didn't quite know. You know, I know there's the red soldiers and the white soldiers, but I don't know, is that the aristocracy and the people? Are they rival factions of the people?
Quite honestly, that does wash over me quite a bit. You know, it's hard because if you don't know the history, I mean, I think you're losing a fair bit of a movie there anyway. But I got into the characters, like, I just didn't. Like Gone with the Wind, we've been hearing about the Civil War quite a bit, so we know a little bit more about that, even if we haven't sort of read about it. It's always
and
been
certainly
there.
World War II, exactly. English Patient, we know more.
Absolutely. But whereas the Russian Revolution, I never learned about it. It's quite confusing at times to see what was going on and who is what, and I agree.
And that's where the Alec Guinness character could have done a bit of voiceover, you know, to kind of explain without being too heavy-handed. I think it could have been done.
Mm.
But I'll tell you one interesting thing I did learn about this film. I spoke to someone last weekend who grew up in China.
Right.
And she was telling me that she loves Dr. Zhivago for all sorts of reasons.
A lot of people do.
Yeah, I know. A lot of other people beyond me absolutely love it. And I'm sure there are people who are listening to this right now and, you know, tempted to turn off in disgust. I'm sorry.
I think they did that at Cabaret.
Okay. But what she said was that the other reason she really loves it is that this was the first Western film they were allowed to watch in mainland China.
Oh, wow.
And I hazarded a guess that, you know, is it because it was very critical of the Russians? But and that may or may not be true. So I just don't understand that those histories and those politics. But I respect that this is a film that people love. It just didn't work for me. And bigger screen, maybe, maybe not. But I just felt like there were parts of the story they hadn't been told but allowed me to believe his characters.
Wow, long stories, amazingly. These are really long stories that can give you the time to get into these characters.
And
you're finding it very difficult.
And that's why I think actually its problem as an epic is that the characters were lost against the epic.
What will you give this, Greg? I'm interested here.
Well, first of all, I'll just give you a hug and then I'll say I give it a 6.
Yeah.
Were you worried it would be worse?
Oh, jeepers. Yeah. A 6 is disgusting. I'm giving it a 9. Okay, you probably thought I was going to give it a 10.
You took my 6 and you turned it upside down.
Yeah, I did.
You took my frown and turned it into a smile.
The reason I give it a 9 is that it could be a 10, but the thing is I think Lean did a better epic, and that was Lawrence of Arabia. That's why I give it a 9. I'm surprised. I really thought you would get into this movie, and I thought, look, it's pure cinema to me.
And so, when I go to the cinema,
I think this is pure cinema. You know what I love? The crowd sequences. No CGI, folks. This is just people. They got people as extras.
And they really killed them.
No CGI, no cut and paste crowds here and there. It's the way movies were made were just amazing, you know?
And you tell the young folk these days and they
won't
believe
you. Well, I'll turn you off, you know? Well, it's amazing when you watch some of those scenes, you go, wow, how did they construct this? I mean, they would have had to have a trillion third ADs on board.
But that's the stuff you and I don't disagree about.
Yeah.
We agree about the spectacle, the craft, the beauty, the technical skill and care. It's the story.
Sometimes I wonder, though, in order to do these big scenes, like the burning of the firing in Atlanta and whatnot as well. To do these scenes, they did them, and how many people? I don't know what OHNS was at that time. Like, there's a sequence in Intolerance, which is D.W. Griffith's Intolerance. That's shot over 4 generations. Okay, so that's the past. It's quite an amazing achievement, Intolerance. If you haven't seen Intolerance, get it. It's not hard to get. Just watch it. It's a 3-hour grand silent movie. It's phenomenal for what they were able to do. But there's this whole war Babylon sequence there, which is, it's like the Lord of the Rings and people falling off these big things. I'm sitting there going, people had to have been killed or seriously injured on this. I don't know how they did it. But that was movie making back then and it was, you had to get the shot. Let's not do it in post. Let's do it in camera.
All right, there will now be a brief musical interlude while we just reset Ricardo to talk about The English Patient.
Okay, after that major shock, Greg, tell us about The English Patient.
If I dare.
Please.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Yes.
Good, then I'll begin. As with all our epics, this 1996 film is set in and around wartime. We've moved through the American Civil War and the Russian Revolution, and now we find ourselves in Europe and North Africa, before, during, and immediately after World War II. Hannah, Juliette Binoche, is a French-Canadian nurse in Italy in the last year of the war. She's lost her lover, and then her best friend, and she's had enough. She asks to leave her convoy to set up in an old, I think, monastery, to care for a horribly burned and dying amnesiac, the English patient of the title, played by Ralph Fiennes. Over time, she's joined by others. A fellow Canadian, the improbably named David Caravaggio, Willem Dafoe, who has his own agenda for the dying man, and 2 bomb disposal experts, Naveen Andrews and Kevin Whatley. Through flashbacks, we begin to see the patient's backstory, discovering that he is in fact a Hungarian count with an impeccable British accent. These flashbacks and some of his developing reminiscences tell the love story of the count and Catherine, Kristen Scott Thomas, and the journeys of their Royal Geographical Society map-making expedition, an expedition that includes Julian Wadham and Colin Firth as Catherine's aviator husband. Both timelines within the film speak of maps, borders, countries, and of ownership, and of how these labels are both useful and forlorn in hope. As with all today's epics, there are many deaths in this period piece, within landscapes that are sumptuous and breathtakingly filmed. Ricardo, if you settle down, what did you think?
You know, I saw this film at the cinema when it came out in 96, and there was a lot of talk about it because some people found it really boring. And I remember there was a lot of radio about it.
Thought it was style over substance.
Yeah, but boring was the big one. Like, boring, The English Patient's so boring. But I love an epic, so I went into it thinking this is going to be beautiful. And I tell you, I found this film breathtaking on so many levels.
Oh, yeah, I'm with you.
I think the locations are beautiful. Let's not go into the locations. They're all beautiful in every epic. I think that's a given.
Yeah, it's almost a requirement.
And even the cinematography is beautiful. But from the opening scene where we see the brush strokes on the paper, that really haunting song, moving to the plane, flying over the endless desert, the beautiful looking desert, which were like, I don't know, they were really contours, so like a female body as well.
I think that's deliberate. And echoed later on when they talk about that hilltop that looks like a woman lying on her side. I think there's a lot that's going on there.
The acting, Ralph Fiennes is phenomenal. The love story between him and Kristen is very believable. In Kristen Scott Thomas is very believable. I found it wonderful in every moment of it. You know, interestingly, at my experience of it in 1996, I was seeing a girl at the time, and I took her to the cinema to see The English Patient. We'd been seeing each other for 3 weeks.
I can guess where this is going.
Well, we're in the cinema. It's halfway through. I'm loving it. The cinema is my church, so I'm loving this movie. It's pure, beautiful cinema. And she leans over to me and she says, "I'm just going to go outside to have a cigarette." And that was it. That was over. We never saw each other again after that night. Ever again. I thought I'd share that story with you.
Doesn't that just happen to you? You know, you go and see something with someone, like Dr. Zhivago, and it doesn't resonate with them, and it really leaves you questioning the whole relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. It really does. Look, go on, Greg.
More seriously, I'm with you on this. I remember seeing this when it first came out at the movies, and somewhere between liking and loving it, and this time I really loved it, even though it was on the small screen. And again, I believed the characters, and this is where you and I disagree about Zhivago, obviously, but I believe this relationship. I've seen some stuff that says, you know, it's not really clear why the Count falls in love with Catherine, but now I get it. You know, he's holding himself back at first, then they're stuck in that cabin in the sandstorm together where they really connect and he lets his guard down a bit.
He does.
And then they have the, you know, the mad passionate love stage and relaxing in his bathtub together, and then the almost hide and seek of the relationship in the public arena, and then where she says, "I can't do this anymore," and he gets very upset and petulant.
Mm.
So he's not quite the hero at that stage. All that I totally, totally believed, because I felt like we were not only told, but we saw, and we not only saw, but we were told. And it was just believable.
It was. And there's so many love stories in this. So there's a lot of love stories here, very different kinds of love.
Her and her husband, Colin Firth.
That's right.
There's allusions made to one of the mapmakers and the youngish Arab man, which is sort of just touched on a bit. What else are you thinking
of? Oh, there's Juliette Binoche and looking after.
Of course, yes.
As a form of love, looking after the English patient there.
Yes.
Her and Naveen Andrews as well.
Then you've got Kevin Whatley, who some people would know as Lewis from the Inspector Moore series, who we find out towards the end is engaged to a girl in the town.
That's right.
There's a lot of love in the face
of adversity,
death and tragedy and destruction and nihilism.
And yeah, Juliette Binoche won Best Supporting Actress in this, and deservedly so.
Yes.
I really loved her in this. I mean, she's just beautiful to watch anyway. But
who was not great to watch?
Yeah,
I mean, they all looked
was.
Really, really young.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
But, you know, Willem Dafoe, Colin Firth, obviously Ralph Fiennes, although really you should call him Ralph Fiennes because he's got a great name, if I say so myself. Kristen Scott Thomas, who else have I forgotten? Julian Wadham, who plays the Count's best friend, you know, amongst the map makers. Naveen Andrews. Kevin Whatley hasn't got a lot to do, frankly, but you've got people in there who really just know how to do it.
Well, it's interesting.
In a really good literate script with great cinematography.
It's interesting. Oh, Australian cinematographer as well, John
Seale.
Yeah. Yes. There's a moment at the end of the movie which is very similar, as we were talking about before, to Dr. Zhivago, okay, when he's got to get back to his family to something, right?
Yep.
Now, I found in The English Patient that was a lot stronger than that moment in Dr. Zhivago.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that I didn't feel for the characters at the moment. You know, I still felt quite emotionally involved in Dr. Zhivago that way, and I think it has its own, you know, reasons why I'm moved by it. But But within The English Patient, that has me sobbing.
Yeah, I felt the same. Because you know she's dying alone in a cave in the dark, and he's made this promise. And for circumstances not only beyond his control, like in Zhivago, but in fact prejudices against who he is, that that put him in a situation where he, I think he ends up killing a man. Does he kill him?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he does.
Because he's desperate to get back to her to keep this promise.
Which is quite an interesting moment, actually. It's interesting that they chose to do that. The writing team obviously was written by Michael Odonice, is that right? Yeah,
yep, the novel, yes.
Yeah, the novel. So, but it's interesting the way that they chose that, because you're thinking you're trying to save a life and you've just killed a young man. You could have knocked him out or something like that. You know what I mean? Well, it's interesting storytelling-wise why they did that, but it shows a desperation.
It may or may not be in the novel, because I think the screenplay was written by the director, Anthony Minghella.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
I think.
The late Anthony Minghella now, what a tragic loss.
I know. And you know that Truly Madly Deeply is also one of my favourite films for me. But, you know, there are significant differences, as I understand. I've just started actually reading the novel, having watched this film again. And I understand that the end of the novel, Naveen Andrews' character, the bomb disposal guy, leaves in disgust because of the dropping of the atomic bomb. And, and he kind of basically rejects the world of white people.
Oh, wow.
I think is the case of what I understand.
Well, he's a really interesting character. He doesn't give a lot away, Naveen Andrews' character there. So when he loses his best friend, who
Kevin Whatley.
And he sort of starts rejecting the world around him and has to leave, ultimately.
But with the possibility that he and Juliet Binoche's character might reconnect at the church one day.
Possibly. Yeah, that's the hope.
Yeah.
I mean, I say there's hope at the end of every one of these films, I think.
Well, you said that about Zhivago, but I don't see it. Where's the hope?
At the very end with the daughter. She's found who she is. And you see Alec Guinness, you know, see the mandolin.
I meant to say...
And whatnot. There's hope Balalaika.
Did you think the unplayed Balalaika was a symbol? Because it ends on the whole thing of...
It does.
She plays it like a virtuoso, which Zhivago's mother did, and it's always following around, but it's never played, it's never fulfilled. I thought that I'd like to... unpack that a bit
more.
Yeah,
you're right, actually.
But I didn't find the end all that hopeful.
I saw it as just a
family
connection, But I thought that was hopeful, for her anyway, for her knowing what her past was and knowing that, you know, people who know the past finally, they start to know themselves and then can live.
I think the ending of The English Patient is the most hopeful of these three.
Well, it's tragic what happens. It's such a tragic story.
Yeah, that's part of the beauty of it, you know, is that, the sobbing that you can find yourself because of just that horrible... And I'd forgotten... I knew she died, but I couldn't remember what happened and the fact that, he'd been caught up. Did you know he's actually an historical character? The actual Count?
Is that actually a real...
And probably was a spy.
Oh, wow. No, I didn't know that, because it says at the very end, it's got a proviso at the end saying, this is a work of fiction, please, this is a work of fiction.
And you ready for me to disabuse you of all your romantic notions?
What's that?
He was gay.
Right.
It seems fairly clear he had relationships with some of the local princes, for example. So knowing that much, for me, makes it a very interesting choice for Michael Odonice, the novelist, to choose him to turn this very romantic figure, although I think some of that came out on the back of the film, having such high profile. It's a beautifully romantic story. And as you say, the opening, which I'd totally forgotten. So you're watching... a surface, which I'm not sure in the end if that was her notebook or actually a wall.
I think it is her notebook.
And you hear the chanting song.
Yeah, which is
while you're watching something being painted, and then eventually you realise it's a person.
That's right.
In a very particular style. And apparently the swimmer's cave is a real place as well.
Yeah,
so,
it is,
it's a very powerful opening.
Oh, even the bit, there's some really lovely moments here as well when, Naveen Andrews brings...
Her to the church. Oh, yes.
And
which is the scene that everyone was showing at the time.
It was the shot in the trailer.
During the Oscars.
Yeah, it was.
It was a shot of her being hoisted up on the rope with a flare.
Yeah, with a flare. It's beautifully done.
Seeing these frescoes.
It's gorgeously done. It really is.
I had one little jarring note.
There's always a jarring
note. Yeah, it's an unfortunate thing. When he's lying in bed with, the makeup on, where he's all burnt and horrible.
Yes.
And the voice used, every now and then I was thinking Voldemort.
Yeah. You know what? I actually didn't think that once. I'm amazed I didn't.
I thought this was probably good practice for the Harry Potter films.
I actually didn't even think about that. You're right.
This is one moment the voice...
You've just ruined it for the next time.
Oh, so the fact that the historical character was not at all like the fictional character is fine. But the fact that he's Voldemort... Now, just at one point, he used this voice. I thought, oh, it's Voldemort.
No, I didn't. Think of that once. I didn't think of that once.
You can't say his name.
Apparently, a lot of people actually criticised the makeup during that whole, when it came out. There's a lot of talk about it. I mean, I don't find this movie boring whatsoever.
I thought the portrayal of his injuries was quite horrific at the start.
Yeah, I mean,
it was very almost, you know, skipped over in terms of the crash.
Mm.
But the parts afterwards where he's on a like a sled kind of thing or whatever he was on, and they put that white cutout thing over his face.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the injury by implication rather than actually seeing it. A bit later when he's supposed to be healed, to me that looked a little bit more artificial.
Yeah.
But I didn't mind. And again, this is, you know, 21 years ago. So, yeah, things have moved on since then. I thought it was fine. And in the end, it's the performances that carry the film.
Love it. What are you going to give this one?
For me, this is a 9.
Yeah.
And it's not quite at a 10 because I don't think it really does something that little bit extraordinary, but it's such a perfect gem. And, you know, we call it an epic. And in this case, I think we're calling it an epic because of its sweep and the whole idea of, you know, for all these films, there's some big set of traumatic world events going on, and you, in all cases, you have a love story set against
those.
That's
right.
And so in that case, it's epic. But this is actually the shortest of the films.
It is.
It's only about 2.5 hours.
2:40.
Yeah, something like 40 that.
40 minutes, yeah.
And it doesn't do what the other two films does. We don't have the overture music slide.
No,
we don't have the intermission followed by the entr'act followed by the exit music. You know, it just tells a good old-fashioned story in a good old-fashioned way.
It does.
I knew I liked it, but I walked away this time loving it. I just think it's so well done.
Yeah, it is, and I'm going to give it a 9 too. I agree with you wholeheartedly on that one. And you know what? I'm really happy.
Oh, good.
I'm ending this episode really happy that you really love this one because honestly,
unlike our tumultuous middle section,
jeepers, I'm still shocked about that. I really am. Anyway,
oh, well.
But this one here, I agree with you. I love it. I think really you should see all of them really. But The English Patient,
you and I are actually quite aligned on Gone with the Wind and The English Patient. In fact, scores differ a bit for Gone with the Wind, but you know we're responding to the same kind of things in both films.
Yeah,
it's just
true.
Chicago. It just didn't work for me. And look. I'll say it again.
It wasn't critically, maybe it's
the screen context.
It wasn't critically acclaimed when it came out. I think its acclaim came after that. Critics didn't love it, you know, so I think...
What I love about it, you love. My problem is that I can't go as far with you on the admiration of this film.
Look, with Zhivago, I must say, look, when I first saw it, yes, it was on a 70mm Asta big screen. I was concerned watching it now on a smaller screen because I thought, I hope I haven't lost that magic. I hope the film, and it does lose a little bit of its magic.
But you brought that magic with you too.
But I did, yeah, that's right. So that's the difference. So that concludes our
epic
filmmaker film watcher podcast. Next episode, we're actually going to span the world, the breadth of the world, and do some foreign language films.
From across the world.
So we're going to be looking at an Italian film called Ricordati di Me, Remember Me, which is directed by Gabriella Muccino. That's a 2003 film.
And I can tell you now that Riccardo will be introducing that one and doing all the wonderful Italian names and whatever else. And then we're going to talk about a film that Riccardo hasn't seen, which I have seen and love, a Japanese film from 1998 called After Life, directed by Hirokazu Koreeda, I'm hoping that is. I won't say any more about it, but it's a film that I stumbled across once and I just love.
Wow.
And then finally?
And then finally we're going to be going to India and looking at Monsoon Wedding, the 2001 film directed by Meera Nair. So that's going to be an interesting episode and I'm really looking forward to delving into some good foreign films.
So, a biento.
Okay, enjoy. And also, look, if you love our podcast, please like us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, review, comment.
And I should probably add too that if by any chance you're an IT developer who logged onto our podcast because you thought an epics episode was something about tips and tricks for agile development, we're really sorry.
That's a completely in-joke. Yep. Okay, see you next time.
Bye-bye.